This is Audible.
Legend. Book 1 in the Drenai Saga, written by David Gemmell and read by Sean Barrett. Prologue. The Drenai Herald waited nervously outside the great doors of the throne room, flanked by two Nadir guards who stared ahead, slanted eyes fixed on the bronze eagle emblazoned on the dark wood. He licked dry lips with a dry tongue and adjusted his purple cape about his bony shoulders. He had been so confident in the council chamber at Drenan, 600 miles south, when Abilene asked him to undertake this delicate mission, a journey to distant Golgothir to ratify the treaties made with Ulrich, lord of the Nadir tribes. Bartellus had helped to draft treaties in the past, and twice had been present at talks in western Vagria and south in Mashrapur. All men understood the value of trade and the necessity to avoid such costly undertakings as war. Ulrich would be no exception. True, he had sacked the nations of the northern plain, but then they had bled his people dry over the centuries with their taxes and raids. They had sown the seeds of their own destruction. Not so the Drenai. They had always treated the Nadir with tact and courtesy. Abilene himself had twice visited Ulrich in his northern tent city and been royally received. But Bartellus had been shocked at the devastation in Golgothir. That the vast gates had been sundered was no surprise, but many of the defenders had been subsequently mutilated. The square within the main keep boasted a small mound of human hands. Bartellus shivered and wrenched his mind from the memory. For 3 days they had kept him waiting, but they had been courteous, even kindly. He adjusted his cape again, aware that his lean, angular frame did little justice to the herald's garb. Taking a linen cloth from his belt, he wiped the sweat from his bald head. His wife constantly warned him that his head shone dazzlingly whenever he grew nervous. It was an observation he would have preferred left unspoken. He slid a glance at the guard to his right, suppressing a shudder. The man was shorter than he, wearing a spiked helm fringed with goatskin. He wore a lacquered wooden breastplate and carried a serrated spear. His face was flat and cruel, the eyes dark and slanted. If Bartellus ever needed a man to cut off someone's hand... He glanced to his left, and wished he hadn't, for the other guard was looking at him. He felt like a rabbit beneath a plunging hawk and hastily returned his gaze to the bronze eagle on the door. Mercifully, the wait ended, and the doors swung open. Taking a deep breath, Bartellus marched inside. The room was long, 20 marble pillars supporting a frescoed ceiling. Each pillar carried a burning torch, which cast gaunt, dancing shadows to the walls beyond, and by each pillar stood a Nadir guard, bearing a spear. Eyes fixed firmly ahead, Bartellus marched the 50 paces to the throne on the marble dais. Upon it sat Ulrich, warlord of the north. He was not tall, but he radiated power, and as Bartellus moved into the center of the room, he was struck by the sheer dynamism of the man. He had the high cheekbones and midnight hair of the Nadir, but his slanted eyes were violet and striking. The face was swarthy, a trident beard creating a demonic appearance, which was belied by the warmth of the man's smile. But what impressed Bartellus most was that the Nadir lord was wearing a white Drenai robe, embroidered with Abilene's family crest, a golden horse rearing above a silver crown. The herald bowed deeply. "My lord, I bring you the greetings of Lord Abilene, elected leader of the free Drenai people." Ulrich nodded in return, waving a hand for him to continue. "My Lord Abilene congratulates you on your magnificent victory against the rebels of Golgothir and hopes that, with the horrors of war now behind you, you will be able to consider the new treaties and trade agreements he discussed with you during his most enjoyable stay last spring. I have here a letter from Lord Abilene, and also the treaties and agreements." Bartellus stepped forward, presenting 3 scrolls. Ulrich took them, placing them gently on the floor beside the throne.
"Thank you, Bartellus," he said. "Tell me, is there truly fear among the Draenei that my army will march on Drosdilnok?"
"You jest, my lord?"
"Not at all," said Ulrich innocently, his voice deep and resonant. "Traders tell me there is great discussion in Drenan."
"Idle gossip merely," said Bartellus. "I helped to draft the agreements myself, and if I can be of any help with the more complex passages, I would consider it a pleasure to assist you."
"No, I am sure they are in order," said Ulrich. "But you do realize my shaman, Nostrakhan, must examine the omens. A primitive custom, I know. But I am sure you understand."
"Of course, such things are a matter of tradition," said Bartellus.
Ulrich clapped his hands twice, and from the shadows to the left came a wizened old man in a dirty goatskin tunic. Under his skinny right arm he carried a white chicken, and in his left hand was a wide, shallow wooden bowl. Ulrich stood as he approached, holding out his hands and taking the chicken by the neck and legs. Slowly Ulrich raised it above his head. Then, as Bartellus's eyes widened in horror, he lowered the bird and bit through its neck, tearing the head from the body. The wings flapped madly and blood gushed and spattered, drenching the white robe. Ulrich held the quivering carcass over the bowl, watching as the last of its lifeblood stained the wood. Nostrakhan waited until the last drop oozed from the flesh, and then lifted the bowl to his lips. He looked up at Ulrich and shook his head. The warlord tossed the bird aside and slowly removed the white robe. Beneath it he wore a black breastplate and a belted sword. From beside the throne he lifted the war helm of black steel fringed with silver fox fur and placed it on his head. He wiped his bloody mouth on the Draenei robe and carelessly tossed it towards Bartellus. The herald looked down at the blood-covered cloth at his feet.
"I am afraid the omens are not pleasant," said Ulrich.
Chapter 1. Rek was drunk, not enough to matter, but enough not to matter, he thought, staring at the ruby wine, casting blood shadows in the lead crystal glass. A log fire in the hearth warmed his back, the smoke stinging his eyes, the acrid smell of it mixing with the odor of unwashed bodies, forgotten meals, and musty, damp clothing. A lantern flame danced briefly in the icy wind as a shaft of cold air brushed the room. Then it was gone as a newcomer slammed shut the wooden door, muttering his apologies to the crowded inn. Conversation, which had died in the sudden blast of frosty air, now resumed, a dozen voices from different groups merging into a babble of meaningless sounds. Rick sipped his wine. He shivered as someone laughed. The sound was as cold as the winter wind beating against the wooden walls. "Like someone walking over your grave," he thought. He pulled his blue cloak more tightly about his shoulders. He did not need to be able to hear the words, to know the topic of every conversation. It had been the same for days. War. Such a little word. Such a depth of agony. Blood, death, conquest, starvation, plague, and horror. More laughter burst upon the room.
"Barbarians!" roared a voice above the babble. "Easy meat for Draenei lances!"
More laughter. Rek stared at the crystal goblet. So beautiful, so fragile, crafted with care, even love, multifaceted like a gossamer diamond. He lifted the crystal close to his face, seeing a dozen eyes reflected there. And each accused. For a second he wanted to crush the glass into fragments, destroy the eyes and the accusation. But he did not. "I am not a fool," he told himself. "Not yet." Horeb, the innkeeper, wiped his thick fingers on a towel and cast a tired yet wary eye over the crowd, alert for trouble, ready to step in with a word and a smile before a snarl and a fist became necessary. War. What was it about the prospect of such bloody enterprises that reduced men to the level of animals? Some of the drinkers, most in fact, were well known to Horeb. Many were family men, farmers, traders, artisans. All were friendly, most were compassionate, trustworthy, even kindly. And here they were, talking of death and glory, and ready to thrash or slay any suspected of Nadir's sympathies. The Nadir! Even the name spoke of contempt. But they'll learn, he thought sadly. Oh, how they'll learn. Horeb's eyes scanned the large room, warming as they lighted upon his daughters, who were clearing tables and delivering tankards. Tiny Dori, blushing beneath her freckles at some ribald jest. Bessa, the image of her mother, tall and fair. Nessa, fat and plain and loved by all, soon to marry the baker's apprentice, Norvas. Good girls. Gifts of joy. Then his gaze fell on the tall figure in the blue cloak, seated by the window.
Damn you, Reg, snap out of it, he muttered,
knowing the man would never hear him. Horeb turned away, cursed, then removed his leather apron and grasped a half-empty jug of ale and a tankard. As an afterthought, he opened a small cupboard and removed a bottle of port he had been saving for Nessa's wedding.
A problem shared is a problem doubled, he said,
squeezing into the seat opposite Reg. A friend in need is a friend to be avoided, Reg countered, accepting the proffered bottle and refilling his glass. I knew a general once, he said, staring at the wine, twirling the glass slowly with his long fingers. Never lost a battle. Never won one, either.
How so? Asked Horeb.
You know the answer. I've told you before.
I have a bad memory. Anyway, I like to listen to you tell stories. How could he never lose and never win?
He surrendered whenever threatened, said Reg. Clever, eh?
How come men followed him if he never won?
Because he never lost. Neither did they.
Would you have followed him? Asked Horeb.
I don't follow anyone any more. Least of all generals. Reg turned his head, listening to the interweaving chatter. He closed his eyes, concentrating. Listen to them, he said softly. Listen to their talk of glory.
They don't know any better, Reg, my friend. They haven't seen it, tasted it. Crows like a black cloud over a battlefield, feasting on dead men's eyes. Foxes jerking at severed tendons. Worms, stop it, damn you! I don't need reminding. Well, I'm damned if I'll go.
When's Nessa getting married?
In 3 days, answered Horeb. He's a good boy. He'll look after her. Keeps baking her cakes. She'd be like a tub before long.
One way or another, said Reg with a wink.
Indeed, yes, answered Horeb, grinning broadly.
The men sat in their own silence, allowing the noise to wash over them, each drinking and thinking, secure within their circle of two. After a while, Reg leaned forward.
The first attack will be at Drostelnok, he said.
Do you know, they've only 10,000 men there?
I heard it was less than that. Abilene's been cutting back on the regulars and concentrating on militia. Still, there are 6 high walls and a strong keep. And Delnar's no fool. He was at the Battle of Skiln.
Really? Said Reg. I heard that was one man against 10,000 hurling mountains on the foe.
The saga of Druss the legend, said Horeb, deepening his voice. The tale of a giant whose eyes were death and whose axe was terror. Gather round, children, and keep from the shadows, lest evil lurks as I tell my tale.
You bastard, said Reg. That used to terrify me. You knew him, didn't you?
The legend, I mean. A long time ago. They say he's dead, If not, he must be over 60. We were in 3 campaigns together, but I only spoke to him twice. I saw him in action once, though.
Was he good? Asked Rec.
Awesome. It was just before Skeln and the defeat of the Immortals. Just a skirmish, really. Yes, he was very good.
You're not terribly strong on detail, Horeb.
You want me to sound like the rest of these fools, jabbering about war and death and slaying?
Nope, said Rec, draining his wine.
No, I don't. You know me,
don't you?
Enough to like you, regardless.
Regardless of what?
Regardless of the fact that you don't like yourself.
On the contrary, said Rec, pouring a fresh glass, I like myself well enough. It's just that I know myself better than most people.
You know, Rec, sometimes I think you ask too much of yourself.
No. No, I ask very little. I know my weaknesses.
It's a funny thing about weakness, said Horeb. Most people will tell you they know their weaknesses. When asked, they tell you, well, for one thing, I'm overgenerous. Come on, then, list yours if you must. That's what innkeepers are for.
Well, for one thing, I'm overgenerous, especially to innkeepers.
Horeb shook his head, smiled, and lapsed into silence. Too intelligent to be a hero, too frightened to be a coward, he thought. He watched his friend empty his glass, lift it to his face and peer at his own fragmented image. For a moment, Horeb thought he would smash it, such had been the anger on Rec's flushed face. Then the younger man gently returned the goblet to the wooden table.
I'm not a fool, he said softly.
He stiffened as he realized he had spoken aloud.
Damn, he said. The drink has finally got to me.
Let me give you a hand to your room, offered Horeb.
Is there a candle lit?
Asked Rec, swaying in his seat.
Of course. You won't let it go out on me, will you? Not keen on the dark. Not frightened, you understand. Just don't like it.
I won't let it go out, Rec. Trust me.
I trust you. I rescued you, didn't I? Remember?
I remember. Give me your arm. I'll guide you to the stairs. This way. That's good. One foot in front of the other. Good.
I didn't hesitate. Straight in with my sword, didn't I?
Yes.
No, I didn't. I stood for 2 minutes, shaking, and you got cut.
But you still came in, Rec. Don't you see? It didn't matter about the cut. You still rescued me.
It matters to me. Is there a candle in my room?
Behind him was the fortress, grim and grey, outlined in flame and smoke. The sounds of battle filled his ears, and he ran, heart pounding, his breathing ragged. He glanced behind him. The fortress was close, closer than it had been. Ahead were the green hills sheltering the Centran plain. They shimmered and retreated before him, taunting him with their tranquility. He ran faster. A shadow fell across him. The gates of the fortress opened. He strained against the force pulling him back. He cried and begged, but the gates closed, and he was back at the center of the battle, a bloody sword in his shaking hand. He awoke, eyes wide, nostrils flared, the beginning of a scream swelling his lungs. A soft hand stroked his face, and gentle words soothed him. His eyes focused. Dawn was nearing, the pink light of a virgin day piercing the ice on the inside of the bedroom window. He rolled over.
You were troubled in the night,
Besa told him, her hand stroking his brow. He smiled, pulled the goose-down quilt over his shoulder, and drew her to him under the covers.
I'm not troubled now, said Rec. How could I be?
The warmth of her body aroused him, and his fingers caressed her back.
Not today, she said, kissing him lightly on the forehead and pulling away.
She threw back the quilt, shivered, and ran across the room, gathering her clothes.
It's cold, she said, colder than yesterday.
It's warm in here,
he offered, raising himself to watch her dress. She blew him a kiss. You're fine to romp with, Rick, but I'll have no children by you. Now get out of that bed. We've a party of travellers coming in this morning, and the room is let. You're a beautiful woman, Bessa. If I had any sense, I'd marry you. Then it's a good job you have none, for I'd turn you down, and your ego would never stand it. I'm looking for someone more solid. Her smile took the sting from her words. Almost. The door opened and Horeb bustled in, bearing a copper tray containing bread, cheese, and a tankard.
"How's the head?"
he asked, placing the tray on the wooden table by the bed.
"Fine," said Rick. "Is that orange juice?"
"It is, and it'll cost you dear. Nessa waylaid the Vagrian trader as he left the ship. She waited an hour and risked frostbite just to get oranges for you. I don't think you're worth it."
"True," smiled Rick. "Sad, but true." "Are you really heading south today?" asked Pesa, as Rick sipped his fruit juice. He nodded. "You're a fool. I thought you'd had enough of Reynard." "I'll avoid him. Are my clothes cleaned?"
"Dory spent hours on them," said Bessa. "And for what? So that you can get them filthy in Graven Forest?"
"That's not the point. One should always look one's best when leaving a city."
He glanced at the tray.
"I can't fish the cheese." "Doesn't matter," said Horeb. "It's still on the bill."
"In that case, I'll force myself to eat it.
Any other travellers today?"
"There's a spices caravan heading for Lentria. That will go through Graven. 20 men, well-armed. They're taking the circular route, south and west. There's a woman travelling alone, but she's already left," said Horeb. "Lastly, there's a group of pilgrims, but they don't leave until tomorrow."
"A woman?"
"Not quite," said Bessa, "but almost."
"No, girl," said Horeb, smiling broadly. "It's not like you to be catty. A tall girl, with a fine horse, and she's armed."
"I could have travelled with her," said Rick. "It might have made the journey more pleasant."
"And she could have protected you from Reynard," said Bessa. "She looked the part."
"Now come on, Regnack, get dressed. I've not the time to sit here and watch you breakfast like a lord. You've caused enough chaos in this house."
"I can't get up while you're here," protested Rick. "It wouldn't be decent."
"You idiot," she said, gathering up the tray. "Get him up, father, else he'll lie there all day."
"She's right, Rick," said Horeb, as the door closed behind her. "It's time for you to move. And knowing how long it takes you to prepare your public appearance, I think I'll leave you to get on with it. One must look one's best when leaving a city, I know. That's what you always say, Rick. I'll see you downstairs."
Once alone, Rick's manner changed, the laughter lines about his eyes easing into marks of tension. Sorrow, almost. The Draenei were finished as a world power. Ulric and the Nadir tribes had already begun their march upon Draenei, and they would ride into the cities of the plains on rivers of blood. Should every Draenei warrior kill 30 tribesmen, still there would be hundreds of thousands left. The world was changing, and Rick was running out of places to hide. He thought of Horeb and his daughters. For 600 years the Draenei race had stamped civilization on a world ill-suited to it. They had conquered savagely, taught wisely, and, in the main, ruled well. But they had arrived at their sunset, and a new empire was waiting, ready to rise from the blood and ashes of the old. He thought again of Horeb and laughed. "Whatever happens, there is one old man who will survive," he thought. "Even the Nadir need good inns. And the daughters? How would they fare when the hordes burst the city gates?" Bloody images flooded his mind.
"Damn!"
he shouted, rolling from the bed to push open the ice-sealed window. The winter wind struck his bed-warmed body, snatching his mind back to the reality of today and the long ride south. He crossed to the bench on which his clothes had been laid out and swiftly dressed. The white woolen undershirt and the blue hose were gifts from gentle Dori, the tunic with gold-embroidered collar, a legacy of better days in Vagria, the reversed sheepskin jerkin and gold ties, a present from Horeb, and the thigh-length doe-skin boots, a surprise gift from a weary traveller at an outland inn. And he must have been surprised, thought Rick, remembering the thrill of fear and excitement as he had crept into the man's room to steal them only a month since. By the wardrobe stood a full-length bronze mirror where Rec took a long look at his reflection. He saw a tall man with shoulder-length brown hair and a well-trimmed moustache, cutting a fine figure in his stolen boots. He looped his baldric over his head and placed his longsword in the black and silver sheath. "What a hero," he told his reflection, a cynical smile on his lips. "What a gem of a hero." He drew the sword and parried and thrust at the air, one eye on his reflection. The wrist was still supple, the grasp sure. "Whatever else you are not," he told himself, "you are a swordsman." From the sill by the window he took the silver circlet talisman, his good luck charm since he stole it from a brothel in Lentria, and placed it over his forehead, sweeping his dark hair back over his ears. "You may not actually be magnificent," he told his reflection, "but by all the gods in Misael, you look it." The eyes smiled back at him. "Don't you mock me, Regnag Wanderer," he said. Throwing his cloak over his arm, he strolled downstairs to the long room, casting an eye over the early crowd. Oreb hailed him from the bar.
"Now that's more like it, Rec, my lad," he said, leaning back in mock admiration. "You could have stepped straight from one of Serbar's poems. Drink?"
"No, I think I will leave it a while yet. Like 10 years. Last night's brew is still fermenting in my gullet. Have you packed me some of your vile food for the journey?
Maggoty biscuits, mildew cheese, and a 2-year-old back of bacon that will come when you call it," answered Horeb. "And a flask of the worst—"
Conversation ceased as the seer entered the inn, his faded blue habit flapping against bony legs, his quarterstaff tapping on the wooden boards. Rex swallowed his disgust at the man's appearance and avoided glancing at the ruined sockets where once the man's eyes had been. The old man pushed out a hand, of which the third finger was missing.
"Silver for your future," he said,
his voice like a dry wind whispering through winter branches.
"Why do they do it?" whispered Horeb.
"Their eyes, you mean?" countered Rec.
"Yes. How can a man put out his own eyes?"
"Damned if I know. They say it aids their visions. Sounds about as sensible as cutting off your staff in order to aid your sex life. It takes all sorts, Horeb, old friend."
Drawn by the sound of their voices, the old man hobbled nearer, hand outstretched.
"Silver for your future," he intoned.
Rec turned away.
"Go on, Rec," urged Horeb. "See if the journey bodes well. Where's the harm?"
"You pay. I will listen," said Rec.
Horeb thrust a hand deep into the pocket of his leather apron and dropped a small silver coin into the old man's palm.
"For my friend here," he said. "I know my future."
The old man squatted on the wooden floor and reached into a tattered pouch, producing a fistful of sand which he sprinkled about him. Then he produced 6 knuckle bones bearing crafted runes.
"They're human bones, aren't they?" whispered Horeb.
"So they say," answered Rec.
The old man began to chant in the elder tongue, his quavering voice echoing in the silence. He threw the bones to the sandy floor, then ran his hands over the runes.
"I have the truth," he said at last.
"Never mind the truth, old man. Give me a tale full of golden lies and glorious maidens."
"I have the truth,"
said the seer, as if he had not heard.
"The hell with it," said Rec. "Tell me the truth, old man."
"Do you desire to hear it, man?"
"Never mind the damned ritual. Just speak and be gone."
"Steady, Rec, steady. It's his way," said Horeb. "Maybe. But he's going a long way towards spoiling my day. They never give good news anyway. The old bastard's probably going to tell me I shall catch the plague."
"He wishes the truth," said Horeb, following the ritual, "and will use it wisely and well." "Indeed he does not, and will not," said the seer. "But destiny must be heard. You do not wish to hear words of your death, Regnak the Wanderer, son of Argas, and so I will withhold them. You are a man of uncertain character and only a sporadic courage. You are a thief and a dreamer, and your destiny will both haunt and hunt you. You will run to avoid it, yet your steps will carry you towards it. But then, this you know, Longshanks, for you dreamt it yester-eve."
"Is that it, old man? That meaningless garbage? Is that fair trading for a silver coin?"
"The Earl and the legend will be together at the wall, and men shall dream, and men shall die, but shall the fortress fall?"
The old man turned and was gone.
"What was your dream last night, Rec?" asked Horeb.
"You surely don't believe that idiocy, Horeb?"
"What was your dream?" the innkeeper persisted.
"I didn't dream at all. I slept like a log.
Except for that bloody candle. You left it on all night and it stank. You must be more careful. You could have started a fire. Every time I stop here, I warn you about those candles. You never listen."
Chapter 2 Rec watched in silence as the groom saddled the chestnut gelding. He didn't like the horse. It had a mean eye, and its ears lay flat against its skull. The groom, a young, slim boy, was crooning gently to it as his shaking fingers tightened the girth.
"Why couldn't you get a grey?" asked Rec. Horeb laughed. "Because it would have taken you one step too many towards farce. Understatement is the thing, Rec. You already look like a peacock, and as it is, every Lentrian sailor will be chasing you. No, a chestnut's the thing." More seriously, he added, "An engraven you may wish to be inconspicuous. A tall white horse is not easily missed."
"I don't think it likes me. See the way it looks at me?"
"Its sire was one of the fastest horses in Drennan. Its dam was a warhorse in Woundweaver's Lancers. You couldn't get a better pedigree."
"What is it called?" asked Rec, still unconvinced.
"Lancer," answered Horeb.
"That has a nice ring to it.
Lancer.
Well, maybe. Just maybe."
"Daffodil's ready, sir,"
said the groom, backing away from the chestnut. The horse swung its head, snapping at the retreating boy, who stumbled and fell on the cobbles.
"Daffodil?" said Rec. "You bought me a horse called Daffodil?"
"What's in a name, Rec?" answered Horeb innocently. "Call it what you like. You must admit it's a fine beast."
"If I didn't have a fine sense of the ridiculous, I would have it muzzled. Where are the girls?"
"Too busy to be waving goodbye to layabouts who rarely pay their bills. Now, be off with you."
Rec advanced gingerly towards the gelding, speaking softly. It turned a baleful eye on him, but allowed him to swing into the high-backed saddle. He gathered the reins, adjusted his blue cloak to just the right angle over the horse's back, and swung the beast towards the gate.
"Rec, I almost forgot," called Horeb, pushing back towards the house. "Wait a moment."
The burly innkeeper disappeared from sight, emerging seconds later carrying a short bow of horn and elm and a quiver of black-shafted arrows.
"Here, a customer left this behind in part payment some months ago. It looks a sturdy weapon."
"Wonderful," said Rec. "I used to be a fine bowman."
"Yes," said Horeb. "Just remember when you use it that the sharp end is pointed away from you. Now, be gone. And take care."
"Thanks, Horeb. You too. And remember what I said about candles."
"I will. On your way, boy. Be lucky now.
Wreck rode from the south gate as the watchmen trimmed the lantern wicks. The dawn shadows were shrinking on the streets of Drennan, and young children played beneath the portcullis. He had chosen the southern route for the most obvious of reasons. The Nadir were marching from the north, and the fastest way from a battle was a straight line in the opposite direction. Flicking his heels, he urged the gelding forward towards the south. To his left, the rising sun was breasting the blue peaks of the eastern mountains. The sky was blue, birds sang, and the sounds of an awakening city came from behind him. But the sun was rising, Wreck knew, on the Nadir. For the Drenai, it was dusk on the last day. Topping a rise, he gazed down on Graven Forest, white and virginal under the winter snow. And yet it was a place of evil legends, which normally he would have avoided. The fact that instead he chose to enter showed he knew two things. First, the legends were built around the activities of a living man. Second, he knew that man. Reynard. He and his band of bloodthirsty cutthroats had their headquarters in Graven, and were an open, festering sore in the body of trade. Caravans were sacked, pilgrims were murdered, women were raped. Yet an army could not seek them out, so vast was the forest. Reynard, sired by a prince of hell, born to a noble woman of Eulalia. Or so he told it. Wreck had heard that his mother was a Lentrian whore, and his father a nameless sailor. He had never repeated this intelligence. He did not, as the phrase went, have the guts for it. Even if he had, he mused he would not keep them long once he tried it. One of Reynard's favourite pastimes with prisoners was to roast sections of them over hot coals and serve the meat to those poor unfortunates taken prisoner with them. If he met Reynard, the best thing would be to flatter the hell out of him, and if that didn't work, to give him the latest news, send him in the direction of the nearest caravan, and ride swiftly from his domain. Wreck made sure he knew the details of all the caravans passing through Graven, and their probable routes. Silks, jewels, spices, slaves, cattle. In truth, he had no wish to part with this information. Nothing would please him better than to ride through Graven quietly, knowing the caravaner's fate was in the lap of the gods. The chestnut's hooves made little sound on the snow, and Wreck kept the pace to a gentle walk, in case hidden roots should cause the horse to stumble. The cold began to work its way through his warm clothing, and his feet were soon feeling frozen within the doeskin boots. He reached into his pack and pulled out a pair of sheepskin mittens. The horse plodded on. At noon, Wreck stopped for a brief cold meal, hobbling the gelding by a frozen stream. With a thick Vagrian dagger, he chipped away the ice, allowing the beast to drink, then gave him a handful of oats. He stroked the long neck, and the chestnut's head came up sharply, teeth bared. Wreck leapt backwards, falling into a deep snowdrift. He lay there for a moment, then smiled. "I knew you didn't like me," he said. The horse turned to look at him and snorted. As he was about to mount, Wreck glanced at the horse's hindquarters. Deep switch scars showed by the tail. Gently his hand moved over them. "So," he said, "someone took a whip to you, eh, Daffodil? Didn't break your spirit, did they, boy?" He swung into the saddle. With luck, he reckoned, he should be free of the forest in 5 days. Gnarled oaks with twisted roots cast ominous dusk shadows across the track, and night breezes set the branches to whispering as Wreck walked the gelding deeper into the forest. The moon was rising above the trees, casting a ghostly light on the trail. Teeth chattering, he began to cast about for a good camping site, finding one an hour later in a small hollow by an ice-covered pool. He built a stall in some bushes to keep the worst of the wind from the horse, fed it, and then built a small fire by a fallen oak and a large boulder. Out of the wind, the heat reflected from the stone. Wreck brewed tea to help down his dried beef. Then he pulled his blanket over his shoulders, leaned against the oak, and watched the flames dance. A skinny fox poked its snout through a bush, peering at the fire. On impulse, Rec threw it a strip of beef. The animal flicked its eyes from the man to the morsel and back again, before darting out to snatch the meat from the frozen ground. Then it vanished into the night. Rec held out his hands to the fire and thought of Horeb. The burly innkeeper had raised him after Rec's father had been killed in the northern wars against the Satuli. Honest, loyal, strong, and dependable. Horeb was all of these. And he was kind, a prince among men. Rec had managed to repay him one well-remembered night when three Vagrian deserters had attacked him in an alley near the inn. Luckily, Rec had been drinking, and when he first heard the sound of steel on steel, he had rushed forward. Within the alley, Horeb was fighting a losing battle, his kitchen knife no match for three swordsmen. Yet the old man had been a warrior and moved well. Rec had been frozen to the spot, his own sword forgotten. He tried to move forward, but his legs refused the order. Then a sword had cut through Horeb's guard, opening a huge wound in his leg. Rec had screamed, and the sound had released his terror. The bloody skirmish was over in seconds. Rec took out the first assailant with a throat slash, parried a thrust from the second, and shoulder-charged the third into a wall. From the ground, Horeb grabbed the third man, pulling him down and stabbing out with his kitchen knife. The second man fled into the night.
"You were wonderful, Rec," said Horeb. "Believe me, you fight like a veteran."
"Veterans don't freeze with fear," thought Rec. Now he fed some twigs to the flames. A cloud obscured the moon. An owl hooted. Rec's shaking hand curled around his dagger. "Damn the dark," he thought, "and curse all heroes." He had been a soldier for a while, stationed at Dros Cortswain, and had enjoyed it. But then the Satuli skirmishes had become border war, and the enjoyment palled. He had done well, been promoted. His senior officers had told him he had a fine feel for tactics. But they did not know about the sleepless nights. His men had respected him, he thought, but that was because he was careful, even cautious. He had left before his nerve could betray him. "Are you mad, Rec?" Ganjavi had asked him when he resigned his commission. "The war is expanding. We've got more troops coming, and a fine officer like you can be sure of promotion. You'll lead more than a century in 6 months. You could be offered the Garn Eagle."
"I know all that, sir. And believe me, I'm really sorry I shall be missing the action. But it's a question of family business. Damn, I would cut off my right arm to stay. You know that."
"I do, boy. And we'll miss you by missile. Your troop will be shattered. If you change your mind, there will be a place for you here. Anytime. You're a born soldier."
"I'll remember that, sir. Thank you for all your help and encouragement.
One more thing, Rec," said Ganjavi, leaning back in his carved chair. "You know there are rumours that the Nadir are preparing a march on the south."
"There are always rumours of that, sir," answered Rec.
"I know. They've been circulating for years. But this Ulrich is a canny one. He's conquered most of the tribes now, and I think he's almost ready."
"But Abilene has just signed a treaty with him," said Rec. "Mutual peace in return for trade concessions and finance for his building program."
"That's what I mean, lad. I'll say nothing against Abilene. He's ruled the Drenai for 20 years. But you don't stop a wolf by feeding it, believe me. Anyway, what I'm saying is that men like yourselves will be needed before long. So don't get rusty."
The last thing the Drenai needed now was a man who was afraid of the dark. What they needed was another Karnak the One-Eyed, a score of them, an Earl of Bronze, 100 like Druss the Legend. And even if, by some miracle, this were to happen, would even these stem the tide of 500,000 tribesmen? Who could even picture such a number? They would wash over Dros Delnok like an angry sea, Rec knew. "If I thought there was a chance, I still wouldn't go." Face it, he thought. Even if victory was certain, still he would avoid the battle. Who will care in 100 years whether the Drenai survived? It would be like Skeln Pass, shrouded in legend and glorified beyond truth. War. flies settling like a black stain over a man's entrails as he weeps with the pain and holds his body together with crimson fingers, hoping for a miracle. Hunger, cold, fear, disease, gangrene, death. War for soldiers. The day he left Joss Cortswain, he was approached by one of the culls, who nervously offered him a tight-wrapped bundle. "From the troops, sir," he said. He had opened it, embarrassed and empty of words, to see a blue cloak with an eagle clasp in crafted bronze. "I don't know how to thank you all. The men want me to say... Well, we're sorry you're leaving. That's all, sir." "I'm sorry too, Korvac. Family business, you know." The man had nodded, probably wishing he had family business which would allow him to depart the Dross. But Carls had no commission to resign. Only the Dunn class could leave a fortress during a war. "Well, good luck, sir. See you soon, I hope. We all hope." "Yes, soon." That was 2 years ago. Gan Javi had died from a stroke, and several of Rek's brother officers had been killed in the Satuli battles. No message reached him of individual culls. The days passed, cold, gloomy, but mercifully without incident, until the morning of the fifth day, when, on a high trail skirting a grove of elm, he heard the one sound he disliked above all others, the clash of steel on steel. He should have ridden on. He knew he should. But for some reason his curiosity fractionally outweighed his fear. He hobbled the horse, swung the quiver to his back, and strung the horn bow. Then carefully he worked his way through the trees and down into the snow-covered glen. Moving stealthily, with cat-like care, he came to a clearing. Sounds of battle echoed in the glade. A young woman, in armour of silver and bronze, stood with her back to a tree, desperately fending off a combined assault from three outlaws, burly men and bearded, armed with swords and daggers. The woman held a slender blade, a flickering, dancing rapier that cut and thrust with devastating speed. The three, clumsy swordsmen at best, were hampering each other. But the girl was tiring fast. These were Reynard's men, Rek knew, cursing his own curiosity. One of them cried out as the rapier lanced across his forearm.
"Take that, you dung beetle!" shouted the girl.
Rek smiled. No beauty, but she could fence. He notched an arrow to his bow and waited for the right moment to let fly. The girl ducked under a vicious cut and flashed her blade through the eye of the swordsman. As he screamed and fell, the other two fell back, more wary now. They moved apart, ready to attack from both flanks. The girl had been dreading this moment, for there was no defence but flight. Her gaze flickered from man to man. Take the tall one first, forget about the other, and hope his first thrust is not mortal? Maybe she could take them both with her. The tall one moved to the left while his comrade crossed to the right. At this moment Rek loosed a shaft at the tall outlaw's back, which lanced through his left calf. Swiftly he notched a second arrow as the bewildered man spun round, saw Rek, and hobbled towards him, screaming hatred. Rek drew back the string until it touched his cheek, locked his left arm, and loosed the shaft. This time the aim was slightly better. He had been aiming for the chest, the largest target, but the arrow was high, and now the outlaw lay on his back, the black shaft jutting from his forehead, and blood bubbling to the snow.
"You took your time getting involved," said the girl coolly, stepping
across the body of the third outlaw and wiping her slender blade on his shirt. Rek tore his eyes from the face of the man he had killed.
"I just saved your life," he said,
checking an angry retort. She was tall and well-built, almost mannish, Rek thought, her hair long and mousy blonde, unkempt. Her eyes were blue and deep-set beneath thick, dark brows, which indicated an uncertain temper. Her figure was disguised by the silver-steel mail shirt and bronze shoulder pads, her legs encased in shapeless green woolen trews, laced to the thigh with leather straps.
"Well, what are you staring at?" she demanded. "Never seen a woman before?"
"Well, that answers the first question," he said.
"What does that mean?"
You're a woman.
Oh, very dry.
She retrieved a sheepskin jerkin from beneath the tree, dusting off the snow and slipping it on. It did nothing to enhance her appearance, thought Rick.
They attacked me, she said. Killed my horse, the bastards. Where's your horse?
Your gratitude overwhelms me, said Rick, an edge of anger in his voice. Those are Reynard's men.
Really? Friend of yours, is he?
Not exactly. But if he knew what I had done, he would roast my eyes on a fire and serve them to me as an appetizer.
All right, I appreciate your point. I'm extremely grateful. Now where's your horse?
Rick ignored her, gritting his teeth against his anger. He walked to the dead outlaw and dragged his arrows clear, wiping them on the man's jerkin. Then he methodically searched the pockets of all three. 7 silver coins and several gold rings, the richer. He then returned to the girl.
My horse has one saddle. I ride it, he said icily. I've done about all I want to do for you. You're on your own now.
Damn chivalrous of you, she said.
Chivalry isn't my strong point, he said, turning away. Neither is marksmanship,
she retorted.
What? You were aiming for his back from 20 paces and you hit his leg. It's because you closed one eye. Ruined your perspective. Thanks for the archery instruction. Good luck. Wait, she said.
He turned.
I need your horse.
So do I.
I will pay you.
He's not for sale.
All right. Then I will pay you to take me to where I can buy a horse.
How much? He asked.
1 golden rack?
5, he said.
I could buy 3 horses for that, she stormed.
It's a seller's market, he retorted.
2, and that's final. 3. All right, 3. Now where's your horse?
First the money, my lady. He held out a hand. Her blue eyes were frosty as she removed the coins from a leather pouch and placed them in his palm.
My name is Regnack. Reg to my friends, he said.
That's of no interest to me, she assured him. Chapter 3. They rode in a silence as frosty as the weather, the tall girl behind Rick in the saddle. He resisted the urge to spur the horse on at speed, despite the fear gnawing at his belly. It would be unfair to say he was sorry he had rescued her. After all, it had done wonders for his self-esteem. His fear was of meeting Reynard now. This girl would never sit silent while he flattered and lied. And even if, by some stroke of good fortune, she did keep her mouth shut, she would certainly report him for giving information on caravan movements. The horse stumbled on a hidden route and the girl pitched sideways. Rex's hand lanced out, catching her arm and hauling her back in the saddle.
"Put your arms around my waist, will you?" he said. "How much will it cost me?"
"Just do it. It's too cold to argue." Her arm slid round him, her head resting against his back. Thick, dark clouds bunched above them, and the temperature began to drop.
"We ought to make an early camp," he stated. "The weather's closing in." "I agree," she said.
Snow began to fall, and the wind picked up. Rick dipped his head against the force of the storm, blinking against the cold flakes that blew into his eyes. He steered the gelding away from the trail and into the shelter of the trees, gripping the pommel of his saddle as the horse climbed a steep incline. An open campsite would be folly, he knew, in this freak storm. They needed a cave, or at least the lee of a rock face. For over an hour they moved on, until at last they entered a clearing circled by oak and gorse. Within it was a crofter's hut of log walls and earthen roof. Rick glanced at the stone chimney. No smoke. He heeled the tired gelding forward. At the side of the hut was a 3-sided lean-to with a wicker roof bent by the weight of the snow upon it. He steered the horse inside.
"Dismount,"
he told the girl, but her hands did not move from his waist. He glanced down. The hands were blue, and he rubbed at them furiously.
"Wake up!"
he shouted.
"Wake up, damn you!"
Pulling her hands free, he slid from the saddle and caught her as she fell. Her lips were blue, her hair thick with ice. Lifting her over one shoulder, he removed the packs from the gelding, loosened the girth, and carried the girl to the hut. The wooden door was open, snow drifting into the cold interior as he stepped inside. The hut was one-roomed. He saw a cot in the corner beneath the only window, a hearth, some simple cupboards, and a wood store, enough for two, maybe three nights, stacked against the far wall. There were three crudely made chairs and a bench table, roughly cut from an elm trunk. Rec tipped the unconscious girl onto the cot, found a stick broom under the table, and swept the snow from the room. He pushed the door shut, but a rotten leather hinge gave way, and it tilted open again at the top. Cursing, he pulled the table to the doorway and heaved it against the frame. Tearing open his pack, Rec pulled his tinderbox free and moved to the hearth. Whoever had owned or built the holding had left a fire ready laid, as was the custom in the wild. Rec opened his small tinder pouch, making a mound of shredded dry leaves beneath the twigs in the grate. Over this he poured a little lantern oil from a leather flask, and then struck his flint. His cold fingers were clumsy and the sparks would not take, so he stopped for a moment, forcing himself to take slow, deep breaths. Then again he struck the flint, and this time a small flame flickered in the tinder and caught. He leaned forward, gently blowing it. Then, as the twigs flared, he turned to sort smaller branches from the store, placing them gently atop the tiny fire. Flames danced higher. He carried two chairs to the hearth, placed his blankets over them before the blaze, and returned to the girl. She lay on the crude cot, scarcely breathing. "It's the bloody armor," he said. He fumbled with the straps of her jerkin, turning her over to pull it loose. Swiftly he stripped off her clothing and set to work rubbing warmth into her. He glanced at the fire, placed three more logs to feed the blaze, and then spread the blankets on the floor before it. Lifting the girl from the cot, he laid her before the hearth, turning her over to rub her back.
"Don't you die on me,"
he stormed, pummeling the flesh of her legs.
"Don't you damn well dare."
He wiped her hair with a towel and wrapped her in the blankets. The floor was cold. Frost seeped up from beneath the hut, so he pulled the cot to the hearth, then strained to lift her onto the bed. Her pulse was slow, but steady. He gazed down at her face. It was beautiful. Not in any classic sense, he knew, for the brows were too thick and thunderous, the chin too square, and the lips too full. Yet there was strength there, and courage and determination. But more than this, in sleep, a gentle, childlike quality found expression. He kissed her gently. Buttoning his sheepskin jacket, he pulled the table aside and stepped out into the storm. The gelding snorted as he approached. There was straw in the lean-to. Taking a handful, he rubbed the horse's back.
"Going to be a cold night, boy, but you should be all right in here."
He spread the saddle blanket over the gelding's broad back, fed him some oats, and returned to the hut. The girl's color was better now, and she slept peacefully. Searching the cupboards, Rec found an old iron pan. Unclipping the canvas and steel canteen from his pack, he took out a pound of dried beef and set about making soup. He was warmer now, and removed his cloak and jacket. Outside, the wind beat against the walls as the storm's fury grew, but inside the fire blazed warmth and a soft red light filled the cabin. Rec pulled off his boots and rubbed his toes. He felt good, alive, and damned hungry. He took a leather-covered clay mug from his pack and tried the soup. The girl stirred, and he toyed with the idea of waking her, but dismissed it. As she was lovely. Awake, she was a Haridan. She rolled over and moaned, a long leg pushing from the blanket. Rec grinned as he remembered her body. Not at all mannish. She was just big, but wonderfully proportioned. He stared at her leg, the smile fading. He pictured himself naked alongside her. "No, no, Rec," he said aloud. "Forget it." He covered her with the blanket and returned to his soup. "Be prepared," he told himself. When she wakes, she will accuse you of taking advantage of her and cut your eyes out. Taking his cloak, he wrapped it around himself and stretched out beside the fire. The floor was warmer now. Adding some logs to the blaze, he pillowed his head on his arm and watched the dancers in the flames circle and jump, twist and turn. He slept. He awoke to the smell of frying bacon. The hut was warm, and his arm felt swollen and cramped. He stretched, groaned, and sat up. The girl was nowhere inside. Then the door opened, and she stepped inside, brushing snow from her jerkin.
"I've seen to your horse," she said. "Are you fit to eat?"
"Yes."
"What time is it?" "Sun's been up for about 3 hours. The snow's letting up."
He pushed his aching body upright, stretching the tight muscles of his back.
"Too much time in Drennan, in soft beds," he commented.
"That probably accounts for the paunch," she noted.
"Paunch? I've a curved spine. Anyway, it's relaxed muscle."
He looked down.
"All right, it's a paunch. A few more days of this and it will go."
"I don't doubt it," she said. "Anyway, we were lucky to find this place."
"Yes, we were." The conversation died as she turned the bacon. Rick was uncomfortable in the silence, and they began to speak at the same time.
"This is ridiculous," she said finally.
"Yes," he agreed. "Bacon smells good."
"Look, I want to thank you."
"There," it said.
"It was a pleasure. What about starting again, as if we had never met?"
"My name is Rick." He held out a hand.
"Virai,"
she said, grasping his wrist in the warrior's grip.
"My pleasure," he said.
"And what brings you to Graven Forest, Virai?"
"None of your damn business," she snapped.
"I thought we were starting afresh," he said.
"I'm sorry. Really, look, it's not easy being friendly. I don't like you very much."
"How can you say that? We've only said about 10 words to each other.
A bit early for character assessment, isn't it?"
"I know you're kind," she said. Taking 2 platters, she deftly flipped the bacon from the pan and handed him a plate.
"Arrogant? Think you're the god's gift to the world? Footloose?"
"And what's wrong with that?" he asked. "Nobody's perfect. I enjoy my life. It's the only one I've got."
"It's people like you who have wrecked this country," she told him. "People who don't care. People who live for today. The greedy and the selfish. We used to be great."
"Rubbish. We used to be warriors, conquering everybody, stamping Drenai rules on the world. A pox on it."
"There was nothing wrong with that. The people we conquered prospered, didn't they? We built schools, hospitals, roads. We encouraged trade and gave the world Drenai law."
"Then you shouldn't be too upset," he told her, "that the world is changing. Now it will be Nadir law. The only reason the Drenai conquered was that the outlying nations had had their day. They were fat and lazy, full of selfish, greedy people who didn't care. All nations fall that way."
"Oh, so you're a philosopher, are you?" she said. "Well, I consider your opinions to be as worthless as you are."
"Oh, no, I'm worthless. What do you know of worthless, prancing around dressed as a man? You're an imitation warrior. If you're so eager to uphold Drenai values, why don't you get after Dros Delnok with the other fools and wave your pretty little sword at the Nadir?"
"I've just come from there, and I'm going back as soon as I've accomplished what I set out to do," she said icily.
"Then you're an idiot," he said lamely.
"You were a soldier, weren't you?" she said.
"What's that to you?
Why did you leave the army?"
"None of your damn business." He paused. Then, to break the awkward silence, went on. "We should be at Glenfrinai by this afternoon. It's only a small village, but they do sell horses." They finished their meal without speaking, Rek feeling angry and uncomfortable, yet lacking the skill to pierce the gap between them. She cleared the platters and cleaned out the pan, awkward in her male shirt. Virai was furious with herself. She had not meant to quarrel with him. For hours, as he slept, she had crept about the cabin so as not to disturb him. At first, when she woke, she had been angry and embarrassed by what he had done. but she knew enough about frostbite and exposure to realize he had saved her life. And he had not taken advantage. If he had done so, she would have killed him without regret or hesitation. She had studied him as he slept. In a strange way, he was handsome, she thought, then decided that although he was good-looking, after a fashion, it was some indefinable quality which made him attractive. A gentleness, perhaps? A certain sensitivity? It was hard to pinpoint. Why should he be so attractive? It angered her. She had no time now for romance. Then a bitter thought struck her. She had never had time for romance. Or was it that romance had never had time for her? She was clumsy as a woman, unsure of herself in the company of men, unless in combat or comradeship. His words came again in her mind. What do you know of worthless, prancing around dressed as a man? Twice he had saved her life. Why had she said she disliked him? Because she was frightened? She heard him walk from the hut, and then a strange voice.